Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I will remind you on our way to our conversation with Larry Gibson. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the University of Maryland's Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information about the University of Maryland Women's Health at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/Women's Center. We are joined in the studio once again by Larry Gibson. Larry Gibson, of course, is professor of law here at the University of Maryland School of Law. He's also in private practice, has been for a long time he was changing names, at least over the years, it has Shapiro, Scher, Quino, and Sandler, and was really instrumental in getting BWI named as the Thurgood Marshall Airport. Has written many books, and this is an incredible one. And Larry, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you. It's been a few years, a long time.
It's been a while.
We've been friends.
So tell us first about this book. And folks, join us, by the way, at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com with your thoughts and questions about the young Thurgood. Because this book, it's all about Thurgood Marshall, but it's also about our history. It's about the city's history. I would call it the Black West Side story.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, well, you've put your finger on it. First of all, let's be clear what this is not. This is not a book about Thurgood Marshall's full career. It only takes him to age 13. So it's less a book about what Thurgood Marshall did, but it is because it is mainly a book about what he was like, at the forces that shaped him, his personality, his priorities, his work habits. And the forces consist of sort of three main categories: the environment, so therefore it's a book very much about Baltimore and Maryland during the period from the beginning of the 20th century through the Great Depression. The book is very much about certain people who had impacts on him, family members, role models that he did not know, but he very much emulated, and other people, and about certain key events. It's interesting, as we go through the book and look at this man's early life, one has to ask oneself, suppose this did not happen. Suppose George Armwood had not been lynched 1 week after Thurgood Marshall became a lawyer. What direction would his career have taken? The accident almost of the fact that the National Bar Association Convention, this is the convention of the black lawyers from around the country, occurred in his hometown in his first year as a lawyer in 1934. Suppose though that convention, which moves around the country, had been someplace else and he had not met the leading black attorneys in the country in his first year as a lawyer. So it is a book in which Thurgood Marshall is the principal character, but the second character in the book, the main character, is the state of Maryland. Maryland's economy, Maryland's politics, geography, and sociology during that first third of the 20th century.
And it's about all the influences on his life, the people, his family, where he came from, what they did to instill certain things in him.
I was surprised at how clearly it would be possible to draw the connection between the senior Thurgood Marshall, the later career that we all know about as an attorney and as a justice on the Supreme Court, and his earlier years. But it's possible to identify where certain attributes and certain parts of his later personality and persona came from. Even his speech pattern, his special sense of humor on race matters, for example,
oh, yes,
directly from his father and a couple of grandfathers, the control that he had over the English language that allowed him then to play around with it was from an earlier career. Earlier years. It's interesting. One thing that I discovered, did not know, that Thurgood Marshall was a student of advocacy and was an advocate years before he knew what he was going to advocate for. In this book, A Young Thurgood, because of the cooperation of the family, I was able to get and have permission to print into the book his entire academic record from the ninth grade forward, where you actually see in the book his high school transcript, his college transcript, and his law school transcript. And if one were to examine those, particularly the high school and then the college, you will see where his focus educationally was. Mm-hmm. Thurgood Marshall studied public speaking, rhetoric, logic, Latin, Greek, German, Shakespeare, Milton, American literature. He was intent on becoming a master of the language. Before he gets to law school, Thurgood Marshall has been for 8 years, a competitive debater. I did not know that before I started engaging in this research. Many people saw Denzel Washington's movie about Wiley College in 1935, their debates. In fact, 7 years earlier than that, Thurgood Marshall participated in a debate at Harvard University. He participated in 1927 in the first debate between a black college and a white college. This was Lincoln University, which Marshall was attending, and Penn State.
And the debates here between with Oxford University.
That's right. He debated a team from Oxford University here in the while he was a student at Lincoln. He was the first freshman to ever make the Lincoln team. In fact, you don't see any interest specifically in civil rights advocacy until his last year of law school. So he was a student of the English language. And then after he mastered that, adopted this control of his speaking pattern, his speaking accents. He could sound like a deep Southerner, a Northerner, or a middle state of a person, but that grew out of mastery and control of the language. So it's a fascinating man, and in very much influenced by this state, because Maryland, I try to describe this. This state, I kept in my mind. I'm writing for someone on the West Coast who doesn't even know where Maryland is, and here we have the state that was often referred to as the most northern southern state, the most southern, southern northern state. Thurgood Marshall referred to it as up south. So you had many of the ills of the deep South and many of the cultural and sociological patterns. But at the same time, there were many good people. There were many courageous people. There were judges, white judges, who were willing to enforce the law and to do the right thing. So Thurgood Marshall saw this dual personality in Maryland and decided to appeal to the right thinking, and therefore he began this legal challenge to racial segregation in the state of Maryland, and had the first successes in the nation. The University of Maryland Law School case often is referred to as the first step on the road to Brown versus Board of Education, because it is the first time that any judge in the United States ordered the desegregation of an educational facility. And so Maryland plays this special role in race relations. It's not an accident that Maryland is the state of Frederick Douglass, of Harriet Tubman, of Clarence Mitchell, and of Thurgood Marshall, and many other leaders. It was South enough to have many of the ills of segregation and Jim Crow, but enough of a border state to have strong influences going in the other direction. Throughout the time of slavery, though this was a slave state, at the time of the Civil War, one half of the African-American population in Maryland was free. So if you were walking in the state of Maryland down and saw a black man walking towards you, there was a 50% chance that was a slave, and there was a 50% chance that was a free man. And that kind of dual personality of the state had impacts on shaping Thurgood Marshall.
Now, I was thinking about this. There are so many pieces of this book, and I'm going to go through a lot of them. The young lawyer, the cases he fought, the AIDS case, what you mentioned at the University of Maryland Law School. And I said to you jokingly in the beginning, but not really a joke, that this in many ways was really part of the Black West Side story. I mean, you write in this book about how the Black community developed in Baltimore and how Thurgood's family and grandparents kind of were part of that building from the time when Baltimore was a city where Black folks had no neighborhood but lived in alleys to when the West Side started to develop slowly.
I spent a lot of time in the book on that. The second chapter is called the Baltimore Grocer's Grandson, because both sets of grandparents owned grocery stores in Baltimore. I developed their history before, because both grandfathers had been in the U.S. military, one in the Navy and one was a Buffalo soldier out west. They came, settled here in Baltimore, and in the book I trace their activities and the creation of Black West Baltimore. Thurgood Marshall was born in a time when the city was in transition. There really wasn't any large concentration of African Americans, and what we think of as the Upton, Bolton Hill sort of area was in transition at that point. Large numbers of European immigrants, particularly Italian Americans and Germans, and so the Druid Hill Avenue, McCullough Street, Pennsylvania Avenue area was becoming the principal Black neighborhood upscale in Baltimore, and so I trace that from the beginning of that. I also discuss the downside of that, the efforts to control and to restrict the movement of Blacks with the series of ordinances passed first in Baltimore and then later adopted in other parts of the country that made it a crime for a Black person to move into a block that was predominantly white. And so here again we have this dual personality of the city and of the state on race matters.
I thought about the dual personality with his father, and the name, the original name of the family was Thurgood, as you write.
Yes,
right?
His...
That wasn't his father, but his uncle was Thurgood, and his grandfather was Thurgood.
His paternal grandfather's original name was Thurgood. He changed his to Thornygood.
Thornygood, right.
To Thornygood. But he had a son whose name was Thurgood. That's Thurgood Marshall's uncle, Thurgood. He kept that name. But Thurgood, whose father's name was William, changed his name, the use of his name, in about the second grade from Thurgood to Thurgood. But I also show you in a book that it was never legally changed. I have the birth certificate, which shows his name as Thurgood. And I point out in the book that this was not changed until 1948. At this point, Thurgood Marshall was 48 years old. His father brought an affidavit down to the state office, and they just drew a line through Thurgood and wrote in Thurgood. So what was his real name? It was probably to his death was really Thurgood. And then in the book, the further suggests that, I have an image of his Episcopal Church confirmation, which is at age 14. He's now been, for 7 years, been using the name Thurgood. But when he was confirmed, the church records have his name as Thurgood. And I did a lot of showing of the original documents, an original item in the book.
I mean, you're amazing at that. I mean, everything you've done right here, you find these photographs and documents and wouldn't they just appear for you somewhere?
No. They're
I'm just kidding. I know they don't.
Attics and basements in their scrapbooks. And it takes digging and people's mantelpieces. But, yes, I try to present as many visual things that people could see. Photographs, There are maps of the area that I had drawn originally to show Thurgood's Maryland, Thurgood's, I mean, no, I think I call them Marshall's Maryland, Marshall's Baltimore,
right.
and his a neighborhood. The family has been amazingly cooperative, the immediate family as well as the extended family. I mentioned a few minutes ago the academic records that are in the book. And that was made possible only by letters which Thurgood Marshall Jr., the justice's son, sent to his schools, saying, turn these records over to Professor Gibson. And then the publisher required another set of letters because to make sure that they could publish them, because they said they'd never seen this. One's entire academic record, every course he took and every grade from the ninth grade forward is shown in the book, with an image of the original transcript.
One of the things, there's so many things that struck me about the little things you would put in this book. Take his father, William. He was a character in his own right. And how he was part of what made Thurgood and his brother stand up as men if they were confronted with the N-word or some kind of deeply racist attack, and how different that was from his mother's way, but how he was, how his kind of volatility, drinking, and power really were a huge influence on Thurgood his whole life.
No question about it. That's one of the things that I try to do in this book, and I think for the first time, in terms of any scholar who's examined here, is to give a really clear image of William Marshall. He had a dramatic impact on Thurgood. Thurgood is much like his father. And this is a man who did not have a lot of formal training in terms of schooling, but he read a lot. He insisted that his sons and they engage in real substantive debates at the dinner table. The arguments would continue past the mealtime. And something else that several of Thurgood Marshall's classmates whom I interviewed commented about, it was this multiple session nature of the debates. Most of the students would say, we've had a discussion and whatever happened, it's over. But the debate was never over with Thurgood. Thurgood would go back, do additional research, and a week later want to resume the debate about the same topic, armed now with additional data, when often his classmates and friends had gone on to other matters. I heard that first, then I heard it twice. Then it was a repetitive thing that I heard from Thurgood's friends and classmates. And I'm so glad that I interviewed those people when I did, because they're all deceased now. The actual writing of the book took me 10 years.
Yeah, you've been working on this a long, long time.
Well, that's the formal writing from the point I decided I would write a book. But the research began in 1981. That's when I began to interview people who were his contemporaries, that his relatives, his classmates, his neighbors, even two of his teachers. There was a wave of interviews. At that time, we didn't have a video. These are recorded on little cassettes. Then another group of interviews in 1985, not really sure what I'm going to do with this material. But I knew that these people were elderly, and I wanted to record their experiences. And that was mainly as a result of the personal curiosity that had developed from my very first encounter with Justice Marshall. Yes. Well, no, the photograph. That's the last thing he ever said to me. I'll get to that in a minute, the photograph. But the very first encounter was 1975, July the 1st, 1975, when I went to Justice Marshall's house.
Oh, at 11 o'clock at night.
I was representing Dr. Roland Patterson, the school superintendent, who was in the process of being fired. And Justice Marshall, I asked to issue a temporary order holding up things, and he spent I get to his door. I don't know what his reaction is going to be. And he comes to the door, and the very first thing Thurgood Marshall ever said to me in life is, this had better be a criminal matter. To which I responded, no, Mr. Justice, it's about Baltimore. Now, I didn't know what would be his reaction to that. He said, okay, come on in.
Even though that wasn't in his jurisdiction, that wasn't over.
That's right. He was the justice for emergency orders for the state of Maryland, and what we call the Fourth Circuit includes Virginia and West Virginia, is the chief justice. Thurgood Marshall was the justice for emergency orders for the Second Circuit, which is New York City. So he really had no business even hearing me out, but he did, and he said, I'm going to sign this thing, but the Chief Justice is going to deal with this by the end of tomorrow, and he will rescind it, but you'll have this now. He knew what I was looking for. I was looking for a media hit at that point. So he dealt with that legal matter for about 15 minutes, but I didn't get out of his house for another 2.5 hours. He spent that time entertaining. Really, myself and the other young lawyer named Charles Lee, talking mainly about Baltimore. And he asked us some questions as to, did we know this person or that person? Was this building still standing or this still there? Was this something else still operating? But what I noticed was I got a different impression from that encounter about his attitude towards Baltimore, because everything that had been written described what was supposedly be his hatred of the city, and it was quite the contrary. It turns out he was a Colts fan. He identified himself as a Baltimore. He was running all over the country. So that wasn't true as to that image that had been painted. So that's 1975. Then there would be periodic times when something would come up where I'd get interested in collecting more data. The students at the law school decided they want to name the law school library for him. And I got involved in that matter. And we had a ceremony in 1980. And he had his best friend on the court, Justice Brennan, come in his place. But the press treated it as if he had snubbed Baltimore and didn't want it done. He had given his permission for it to be done. And so I kept here reading things about Thurgood Marshall that did not jibe with what impression I was developing. But still, I would more grumble about it than do anything about it. Until 2002, the then dean of the University of Maryland Law School, Phoebe Haddon, said to me, Larry, I'm tired of hearing you complain about how nobody else understands Thurgood Marshall, and you're the only one who does. Why don't you write the book and set the record straight? And I said to myself and to her, well, okay, I will. So it's 2002 when I finally resolve to write about Justice Marshall. And that's been 10 years ago, and finally it's out.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back and catch some of these calls coming in here, 410-319-8888, Righteous Here, Steiner Show at gmail.com. We're going to take a look at the debating team and what happened at Lincoln University with Dr. Robert Labrie, and the Maryland Black legal history, which we have to touch upon, people like Harry Scythe Cummings, no relation to Elijah Cummings, but Harry Scythe Cummings, and more, things that came up that really are just amazing pieces of history and story that we don't really talk about, and what happened to him at Lincoln University as well. And so stay with us. We'll be right back with Larry Gibson. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're here with the University of Maryland Law School Professor Larry S. Gibson. Larry Gibson has written a new book, this one called Young Thurgood, The Making of a Supreme Court Justice. It deals with his early life here in Baltimore, his life through going to Lincoln University, his early years as a lawyer, and just thoroughly researched and just brings so much to us about early Black Baltimore. It's an amazing piece of history. Let's get a caller in here. We'll come right back to conversation. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow at gmail.com. Afrikan, you've been holding on for a while. You're on the air.
Yes. Could you ask your guest to tell us what the 40 Acres and a Mule was all about? Could he explain that to the listening audience? And does President Obama plan to address that while in office?
Well, there's nothing in this book about that, and that was a part of a promise to Friedman during the during the Civil War, but that deals with an earlier period. This book essentially covers the period from the beginning of the 20th century through the Great Depression. So I'd like to have that discussion with you, but that's not what this book is about today.
We will get back to that. I think it's an important discussion to have. We're just trying to focus on the book here that that Larry Gibson has written on young Thurgood. And one of the things that – let's jump around a bit and let's talk – one of the things I really – I learned so much reading this book, which first of all was about the black legal history, the history of black lawyers in Maryland, of people like Harry Scythe Cummings, a political leader who stood, was a city council member, to Ashby Hawkins. I mean, I didn't know that first the University of Maryland allowed black folks in, not very many, but then banned them. And he was the last of the students. So talk a bit about that incredible history and legacy that you are part of and so many, many, many more lawyers are part of now.
Well, up until 1985, you had to be a white male to practice law in Baltimore, in Maryland, in the state of Maryland.
1885.
That was, 1885. Right. That was changed, and the first black attorney in the state of Maryland was Everett Waring, who also became the first black lawyer to argue any case before the U.S. Supreme Court. There was then a period of time, which I trace in the book, during which there developed a very strong black bar of very influential lawyers, not strong in terms of large numbers. Thurgood Marshall was the 60th black attorney in the state of Maryland, and I'm about the 130th. So we averaged only about two per year. So there was 34 years between the Thurgood Marshall and myself and 70 new black attorneys. So black lawyers were rare, but the book shows that Thurgood Marshall had very strong role models who came before him. You've mentioned W. Ashby Hawkins, who Thurgood frequently referred to as his principal role model. He was Maryland's first great civil rights attorney. Then you've mentioned Harry Scythe Cummings. I have his photograph and a synopsis of his career. Elected to the city council in 1891,
right.
And was the first black elected official in the city of Baltimore. And so, but not only were these men role models stylistically, I show in the book how substantively they set the agenda. If one were to look at the cases that Thurgood Marshall, after he goes to New York and goes to work for the NAACP, argues before the Supreme Court, every one of those cases has a predecessor case or more of cases brought by those other lawyers in Maryland.
So, and this is really important. I mean, because one of the things, as you alluded to earlier, Thurgood Marshall, once he graduated law school at Howard University, we'll come back to a bit of that history, because that's, he wrote a great deal about the growth of Howard while he was there, changing the nature of that law school, and Charles Houston and all that. But his becoming a lawyer and coming to Baltimore, his hometown, and setting up office here, and what happened immediately after that in terms of the last lynching in Baltimore and how that may have transformed who this man became in terms of being a lawyer.
One always wonders what would have happened had certain events not occurred. What would have happened had not George Armwood been lynched 1 week after Thurgood Marshall was admitted to practice? He was lynched in Prince's Anne County.
My friend Cheryl Neifel wrote an incredible book on the courthouse lawn about that particular lynching.
That's right, correct. Right. And the first chapter of this book begins with that and Thurgood Marshall's immediately involvement in the anti-lynching campaign. There are other incidents that occurred. That put him back in touch with his law school dean, Charles Hamilton Houston. And that immediately led to Thurgood's first real trial in court. And it was on behalf of a white attorney. There was an effort to disbar Bernard Aides, a communist attorney, but who had been representing black people on some controversial matters. He asked Charles Houston, Thurgood's law school dean, to defend him. Houston involved Thurgood Marshall in the case. And that is actually the first trial of a major trial that Thurgood Marshall was involved in. So his first trial was on behalf of a white attorney. Suppose that hadn't happened, and there are other things that are events. So in addition to the environment of Maryland, in addition to the people, there were these just happenstances that had dramatic impacts.
And then he never stopped becoming a civil rights attorney. I mean, he did other cases, but he then really became a leading fighter.
That's one thing that becomes clear in the book, and I think here I change what people's perceptions
are. Because
you
did that a number of times. You hit a number of facts that people have thrown out there. You said what you found to be wrong, and you corrected them.
Yes, I try to diplomatically correct several things about the record. There are some inaccuracies about Thurgood Marshall. And yes, I do a fair amount of that, not only in terms of his cases, but also things that he did not handle that some people have said. I must say that some of the I have some sympathy for earlier writers because some of the inaccuracies came from Thurgood Marshall. His recollection was not always clear, and he was a raconteur. He was a storyteller, and I don't say it as strongly as another scholar said did that. Well, he would not let the facts get in the way of a good story, and so there was a fair amount of setting the record straight in the book here. I do it mostly in the footnotes. That's I think a part of the contribution I was was attempting to make.
And the other thing before we go into get these other calls coming in, there was an important part of this book where you wrote about Buy Where You Work, and that campaign,
yes.
And even though it was short lived, it was significant. And significant for Thurgood Marshall as well.
What the significance of the Buy Where You Can Work campaign, which happened right after 2 months after Thurgood Marshall became an attorney, is that, and it was really the community's reaction to the Armwood lynching. It was the community acting on an aggressive, affirmative basis. The Baltimore community. Pretty much everything had been in reaction to something. This was a boycott campaign, picketing and boycotting businesses on Pennsylvania Avenue to force them to hire African-American sales personnel. And Thurgood Marshall got very much involved in that. And you saw some early indications of some other things that I developed in the book, like this diplomacy and negotiating ability, that he goes down and negotiates with the chief of police, the protocol to be followed on the picket line. He was so successful at it that the judge didn't believe it. The judge says, "Well, you must have misrepresented things to the police commissioner." He hadn't. He had been reasonable, and they had worked out something significant. And that was another early client of his, a man named Costoni. I try to develop the people, something about them that had impacts. And so there were other lawyers, but some of his clients. I mean, his experience with Bernard Aides was informative to him. He had some successes and he had some failures. Watching Thurgood Marshall deal with failures was also informative. And there's some of that in the book. But his law practice... he had a fair amount of non-civil rights law practice, and it's clear that he could have had much more. The point that we were making earlier about where I'm trying to set the record straight on that is too many books about Thurgood Marshall give the impression that he handled civil rights cases because it was in the Depression and he didn't have anything else to do. Quite the contrary. You see in this book that whatever he had a choice to make between a fee-producing matter or that part of his law practice or time-consuming, non-fee-generating
right.
civil rights work, he chose the latter. He chose to be involved in those big time-consuming cases. He learned that what he was, he had trained to become an advocate, and he learned that what he was a civil rights advocate, but it was not out of necessity. He made a fair amount of income without even hardly trying in private non-civil rights cases, with what little time he'd be willing to give them what he wasn't handling civil rights matters.
His brilliance came through in that. And there are a lot of women around him.
Yes.
That had a huge influence, whether it's his wife. You have talk about Juanita Jackson, Juanita Jackson Mitchell. There's a beautiful photograph of her in the book when she was young.
There are three photos of her. Yeah. She was so beautiful. There are three photos of young Juanita.
I only met her when she was very old.
Jackson.
You know, she was just gorgeous. I mean, just and
brilliant. She graduates from college at age 16. She actually starts on the national staff of the NAACP a year ahead of Thurgood. Walter White, then the head of the NAACP, brings her to New York in 1935 to begin to work in creating a youth division of the NAACP. And yes, the Thurgood Marshall had many mentors and people involved in his life. Many of them were women. But he had male role models also. That's another thing that I try to get clear. Earlier books comment very much on what clearly was a good relationship, a beneficial relationship he had with his law school dean, Charles Hamilton Houston. But Thurgood Marshall had other real important mentors before that. I develop in the book information about a man named Gough McDaniels,
right,
who was Thurgood Marshall's high school history teacher and debate coach. And you see him involved at each little juncture along the way. And there's even a photograph of him. There's one of Juanita Jackson, and standing in the background there is Gough McDaniel.
Right.
This was a brilliant man who had graduated at the top of his class at Brown University in 1910 and was a leader in this community for a long time.
410-319-8888. We're talking with Larry Gibson, of course, distinguished professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. His latest work is Young Thurgood, The Making of a Supreme Court Justice. 410-319-8888. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. And Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Andrea. Welcome.
How are you guys doing? Oh, I'm just sitting here in awe. I am loving this. I'm still going to buy your book, and that's what I'm going to read during Christmas break. But I wanted to ask, because we were talking to some of my students about Thurgood Marshall, and then, of course, I had to throw in Oklahoma in there. So I was curious about some of his cases. If in your book it does cover anything about Dr. Ada Lois Sibyl Fisher, who was the first female entered in the University of Oklahoma. And so he represented her and actually got her admission.
No, and I couldn't find an excuse to have that beautiful woman's photograph in my book. I tried to find.
Well, that's an excuse.
I've got one up.
Very pretty.
I have her photograph in my office now.
I do too. She was my mentor during the 80s.
Yes.
Now I'm telling my age.
Yeah. This book only goes up to 1938 when Thurgood Marshall is 30 years. It ends as he goes to New York. Well, he's already in New York, but as he becomes the lead counsel in at the NAACP, Ada Fisher's case was 1948. She actually had two cases. Two times her case was argued by Thurgood Marshall before the U.S. Supreme Court. So one was before she was married. At least the title of the case was before she was married, and was Ada Sipiel, and then later. It is amazing how they created a whole law school rather than to have this brilliant woman go to the University of Oklahoma.
So, Andrea, always good to hear from you. Thank you so much for that piece of this. Let's talk about Thurgood as a lawyer for a minute. There are so many cases, whether it was the case in Prince George's County that where the police officer shot, and I'm blocking his name right now. The capital cases he won, or the getting young people out of Cheltenham, things he took on. These were amazing cases that we don't ever talk about.
In the book, I discuss, I believe, every significant case in his few years of practice here in Baltimore. The range of cases is amazing, and he handled six capital cases. The first one, his client was convicted and was hanged. And then he handled another six, and the people were acquitted. He became, as a result of that experience, a lifelong opponent of the death penalty. Yes, this man was a fantastic lawyer, but think of how he did it. It wasn't just a matter of legal research. You see in the book this willingness and ability to just simply work hard and a sort of thoroughness in assembling information. But what you see also is something that I try to show in this book is Thurgood Marshall, the politician, Thurgood Marshall, the diplomat. We think of him as a legal tactician, and I think people have that image. But it is clear that Thurgood Marshall used charm, used a kind of reasonableness as a tool. But part of it is sort of how he was. I think it comes from the debating experience. Thurgood Marshall, well, a couple of experiences. The debating experiences, he had participated in competitive debating since the ninth grade of high school. I mean, major debates. I mean, at Lincoln University, he participated in the first interracial debate between a white and a black school in the nation. One has to prepare to argue either side of a
right.
proposition there. Then the jobs, I did describe them in some considerable detail in the book. 4 years as a dining car waiter on the B&O Railroad.
This While working required, his way through college.
Yes, working his way through college. This required him to immediately assess people. I mean, this train started in Washington, D.C., and there were more than occasionally an unreconstructed rebel. And this was a tough job to begin with, and then just to manage that, and then 4 years as a waiter at
Gibson Island.
So he developed an ability to immediately make assessments about people. Sometimes he would be wrong. I point out in a few times in a book when his assessment was wrong. But he got comfortable with that and was more often than not correct. So we add that to diplomacy. We add that politician nature, which I try to point out several times in the book, to a willingness to be thorough and to work hard, and you end up with a very effective lawyer, a lawyer that many people regard as the most important American lawyer of the 20th century.
And that's an important point to make. Too many people say the most important black lawyer in the 20th century, as opposed to the most important lawyer in the 20th century, which is a huge, you know. Now, one of the things that's little side pieces that really struck me in this book, one, we talked about it off mic for a moment during the break, which was the power of the family around Thurgood Marshall and the influence that had on him. And you made a statement in the book about he always had strong relations and connections to his family. He was always there, pushing him on, just people he related to, people who were his heroes and heroines, people who talked to him, listened to him, how critical this was.
He had a large family, immediate family. It was just his mother, his father, and his brother. But he had, within five blocks, two grandparents, two grandmothers, one grandfather for a short while, but two grandmothers, and nine aunts and uncles. And he was engaged with every one of them. We add to that their friends, and he always seemed to have additional mentors. He goes to work in his high school years for a man named Morton Schoen.
Oh, that's a great story.
Who ran a clothing store,
right.
Women's hats mainly, but they later expanded, but about high class, expensive certainly, clothing in the 300 block of Charles Street. This man immediately sourced something in Thurgood Marshall and became, during that high school period, an additional mentor. He goes to college, and Professor Robert Labrie, who was at Lincoln University, who was a mentor to Langston Hughes and into Clarence Mitchell, saw something and spent time with him. But Thurgood would also spend time. It was a two-way It was a two-way street. Even Judge O'Dunn and some of the other judges, in cases where he, as it to a matter which he was, that case was not before them, he would go to talk with another judge about how to handle this matter. He always seemed to attract mentors, people who wanted him to succeed and were willing to help him succeed, and he was a fantastic listener. And that is the other part of the environment. Maryland had that environment. There were, in this community, white and black people who were willing to see, recognize in this young man some potential and to help him. The manager of the Gibson Island Country Club, Albert Fox, where Thurgood worked during his law school years, and he and Thurgood Marshall had a lifelong friendship that went into the years after Thurgood Marshall becomes a judge. So there was this personality that he had that attracted people who wanted to be counselors to him, and as fierce an advocate as he could be, once he made up his mind, he was also a good listener.
Now, I've got a real appreciation. I mean, you mentioned in Juan Williams' book, and this is as you cited as the best of the books written about Thurgood's life.
About the whole life. Yeah, mine only book only goes up to 30, age 30.
But this was the missing piece.
That was, yes.
This is the missing piece.
Those were books about what Thurgood Marshall did. This is a book about what Thurgood Marshall was like and the forces that shaped him. What molded him, what was he like, and what molded him? How did he get to be like that? And I had fun reading everything that anyone else had written about Thurgood and say, oh, I know where that started. I know what got generated, and I try to do that in this book, Young Thurgood.
So let me tell you, folks, this has, for me, been just a joy to have Larry Gibson on the show once again. He's been coming on the show for 20 years, on and off, over the years, talking
and,
about
and
many
and
different things.
Please come to the Pratt now.
And we're about to renounce that. That's what we're about to do. So Larry Gibson and his book, Young Thurgood, The Making of Supreme Court Justice, will be at the Enoch Pratt just took it away from me to get it back up here. We'll be at the Enoch Pratt Library downtown this Thursday, December 13th, just a few nights from now, 7 p.m. So you don't want to miss it. He'll be talking about Young Thurgood, 7 p.m., Thursday, December 13th at the Central Library, and be there for that. And he'll be there to talk about his book, autograph the book, and more.
That is correct. And thank you. And if you can't come Thursday night, come Friday night, 5:30 to Union Baptist Church.
There you go.
In Thurgood Marshall's neighborhood.
Exactly.
And then if you can't come that, come Saturday to Ivy Bookshop at 7 o'clock.
That's a wonderful little bookstore.
So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, there are opportunities to get the book, and I'd be delighted to sign it for you.
So meet Larry Gibson, and we'll put all those on our website so you can go see them if you've forgotten what we've just said. But it's Thursday night. You can start at 7:30 at the Enoch Pratt Library. Remind before we leave here, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland's offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis, Bobby Marvin Holmes, and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Latrice Eddy and Marissa Edman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find information about our guests, like where Larry Gibson will be speaking, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, it'll be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Stay tuned for Marshall Reeves Jews, and take care.